Jackson, W266DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Special Report. Talk about a great all-around player Willie Mays could hit. And the San Francisco center fielder could catch him. The oldest living MLB Hall of Famer has died. The Giants say he died peacefully Tuesday, surrounded by family. Speaking during his induction into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1979, he remembered a previous slump and a talk with his manager.
Will said to me, son, as long as I'm manager, you are my center fielder. You do not have to hit. Just go out and catch the ball. And from those words from Leo DeRocher, I think, gave me a little courage.
He was Rookie of the Year in 1951 and twice was named the Most Valuable Player. Willie Mays was 93 years old. CBS News Special Report, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Civic Media News, I'm Ella Saff. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Donald Trump tells a rally in Wisconsin Tuesday that he wants to be the law and order president.
I will be the president for law-abiding Americans, every background, every walk of life, every race, religion, color, and creed. I'll be the president.
Trump was convicted of 34 felonies in a recent hush money trial. Trump campaigned in Racine. Wisconsin's Supreme Court will hear a challenge to Governor Evers' 400-year school funding increase. Evers used his line-item veto to make changes that give Wisconsin schools a per-pupil funding boost for the next four centuries. Wisconsin governors have sweeping veto powers, but the courts have put limits on striking single words or letters. Justices announced Monday that they will take the case. And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
Hey, Wisconsin, it's construction season, and the Wisconsin DOT wants to help you safely navigate work zones. Check 511WI.gov or download the app for road work or closures on your route. Know before you go with 511 Wisconsin, sponsored by the Wisconsin DOT.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Shaw. 101.1 FM and 540 AM WAUK. And on the Civic Media app. You're listening to the Shaw, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Had someone question a statement I made recently about the Biden administration's transformational change of our economy, of where we're heading as a country. And this is one of those things that I've been talking about for a while, of the need for the administration to get out there and talk about the aspirational stuff, where we're heading, where the promised land is. Bring us the hope and change of where you're leading us, and doing it in a shorter, easier way. Basically, recreating a prosperous working class, that would be nice. But understand, their messaging machine, their media culture, pretty hard to overcome. And there's a lot of stories out there that we don't get to see, we don't get to hear. The reality is there's a lot of good stuff happening. We just don't hear it because the negative, ugly stuff sells, evidently. And it's what we're being force-fed every day. So what I said, we're having transformational change. We're investing in infrastructure. We're rebuilding manufacturing. We're doing all this kind of stuff. And it was, August of 2022 when the CHIPS Act and the Inflation Reduction Act passed within days of each other, where we were saying, hey, we're going to give like $400 billion in tax credits, grants, loans, that kind of stuff, to build a domestic semiconductor industry, to reclaim that prowess we once had, and to invest in the next generation of clean, green high-tech manufacturing, and that stuff. And I'm like, this is great. This is the transformational stuff we need. Now, understand, part of it was to take on China and, or, you know, reclaim that that top manufacturing spot, or at least protect the growing industries of EVs and solar panels and the future stuff that we think we're going to spend a lot on, and maybe recapture some work from overseas, bring it back. And this person said, well, you know, we've done that in past. I go, no, we've never had in my lifetime. There's never been an industrial policy of what it is that we need to bring to work on, what it is that we need to invest in. It's always been this, at least in my political lifetime, it's always been the invisible hand. Government can't do anything. This, the transformational change here, is returning to the idea that government can have some role in guiding this country and our economy and what kind of an economy in a direction that benefits working people. Because understand, the laissez-faire stuff, get government out of our lives, no regulation, that benefits the very wealthy because they don't have to pay the external costs of pollution. They don't have to pay for childcare and health care and all that stuff that they've basically pushed down onto working people. So for me, this transformational shift is returning us to a day where we wanted an economy that worked for people. And the job creation that's been going on is nothing short of amazing. Honestly and truthfully, every month I keep seeing, you know, more jobs, more jobs, more jobs, even though the Fed is doing their foolhardy best to slow things down. Because understand, their ideas create unemployment so then inflation comes down. That's the model. And you understand that, you know, over the last year, the number of the share of working age, prime working age Americans is at the highest it's been since 2007. And yet all we keep hearing is, you know, nobody's working anymore. You know, the job participation rate is going down. You go, are we looking at the right things? And the answer is no, we're not. Understand, we're an aging population. People are retiring. So when you have retirees, that they're out of the workforce for a reason. They're not participating because they're retired. But we're told, you know, this is falling participation. No, this is a good thing. We want people to retire. At least I think we do, because it opens the door for younger people to get those jobs. But we're at the highest point since 07. When you talk about people who were born in this country, native-born Americans, in the prime of their working life, we're there, over 80%. And yet you don't hear that from the corporate-controlled mainstream media. You don't. And understand, you know, Biden's record, if you're honest, we're record investments in manufacturing spending, record investments in infrastructure. He's got a record of unemployment that, you know, I got to tell you, second to none in my lifetime. The stock market, if that's your barometer of how the economy's doing, actually never better. You look at the fact that you know, he pulled off one of the greatest maneuvers on the gas front, sold off, you know, oil when the prices were high, and then used the power of the federal government to restore the strategic reserves at a lower rate. You know, saving what, almost $500 million? You're not going to hear about that, because that's good news. It's what we should be doing. So when I mentioned this to a friend, you know, they threw up, well, you know, gas prices are still high. And you go, yeah, gas prices are historically right about where they've been. When you take inflation into account, we're right about where we've been. There was that couple of years in the 90s where gas prices were artificially low because, well, we were drilling a lot, and the international community was drilling a lot. They reined that back in to get the prices up. I would argue in a moment of collusion, but you look at the fact that gas prices are right where they should, where they've been for the last several years. And yet I talked to this friend who's like, well, you know, I remember when it was a dollar. And I go, I do too. It was the 1980s. But in today's dollars, it's about the same when you adjust for inflation. Now, we can talk about whether inflation has been a good thing or a bad thing. It's been a bad thing because wages have not kept up. Had wages kept up, had we had the union strength that we had in the 70s for the workers in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s, it would be a whole different story. We haven't kept up with wages. And where has that money gone? As we've grown the economy, as the economy produces massive wealth, as costs go up for products and goods and services, who benefits? And we know who benefits are ultra wealthy. They have done really, really well. We've created the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization. Good on us, I guess. And we've done it through these massive transfers. Energy costs, part of that. I keep saying that we need a tax code much like we had in the 50s, 60s, in that era. You tax the people who at the top who have the biggest shoulders. The people who have the money, that's where you go. Makes sense to me. We talked about yesterday on the program, Warren Buffett saying, look, if the top 800 companies in this country pay taxes like his company does on what they owe, there wouldn't be a need for federal income tax. So I see on Monday, the IRS comes out and is talking about a new rule. And again, this is part of the Biden plan. This is part of the Inflation Reduction Act. This is part of the thing that drives Republicans the craziest, because we allocated some money to the IRS to hire new people to do audits of the very wealthy and big corporations. Because understand for a while, and it's been a long while, we didn't go after big corporations and the very wealthy. We didn't audit, you know, really wealthy individuals or big businesses. We didn't do that because they're complicated. They're hard to do. They're hard to go and get these people to pay what they owe, because, again, they've got armies of lawyers and all of this stuff. So if you don't have the resources to take them on, chances are not going to do it. And we've been doing this from the Bush era forward, because if you remember, you go back to the Bush years, one of the things that George W. did was cut funding to the IRS, you know, and that cut the number of audits of very wealthy people. So what did they do? They went after the low-hanging fruit. They started going after working people. Because hey, we got to find, you know, the pennies, the dollars are out there, but we got to find the pennies. So who'd they go after? They went after poor people, who may have gotten the earned income tax credit and may not have really, really desperately needed it. Seems to be good conservative policy: beat up on the poor people, leave the very wealthy alone. But the Biden folks are saying, nope, we're going to use these resources, and we're now going after this partner basis shifting. And what it basically is you have corporations who, you know, just move money around, move assets around, move things around to other related partners. And this way they can avoid paying taxes. It's a shell game. When I was a kid, they used to play three card Monte. It's you find the queen. You never do. But what this kind of thing has done is it's given the very wealthy and their tax avoidance attorneys another tool to avoid paying what they owe to our country. And, you know, as I said, previous years, you know, because of underfunding, the IRS cut back on auditing these big corporations. So they were getting away with it. And all of this stuff became common practice and the kind of thing you just kind of let go. So now the IRS is saying, hey, we need to go after some of this stuff. They say the filings for large pass-through businesses, you know, the big corporations who use the kind of tax cheating or tax avoidance they're saying that it increased from 2010 to 2019 by 70%. So again, 2010 is an interesting year because, you know, the Bush years ended on January 20th, 2009. His policy to cut that funding to the IRS and thus get rid of some of those agents. It'd be interesting to see if they went back to that date and how the increase in this use of this gimmick was played out. Because look, if there's no cop on the beat, what are you going to do? You're probably going to see people cheating. So now what they're saying, is we're going to go looking at this. Audit rates over that same period of time, this is the interesting part, fell from 3.8% down to 0.1%. So at a time when you're seeing them using this more, where they're using this gimmick more, you're seeing the auditing of them fall. So do you think, just kind of throwing this out here, do you think that this could mean a lot of money? Well, in a statement by the Treasury Department, they're saying estimated about $160 billion gap in what our wealthy 1% likely owe and what they actually pay. $160 billion. And you stop and think about, what could we do with $160 billion a year? What kind of investments could we make? What kind of improvements in our country? What problems could we solve? I saw a thing the other day said for $45 billion, $45 billion a year, we could end homelessness. So you stop and you think about this, $160 billion. We could easily end homelessness three times. But are we going to? Sadly, no. Or at least I hope we will. Hopefully this shift in policy, hopefully this shift in direction, this transformational change will get us moving in the right direction and being able to invest in the things that we need to do, the things that we want to do. Like I said, manufacturing, infrastructure, healthcare, education, social policies to make sure that we have a safety net under people's feet so that when they fall, they don't fall too that far. Now, according to the report, the IRS plans to raise their audit rates with people who have assets over $250 million to 22.6% by 2026. And you go, wow, that doesn't sound like an awful lot. Well, it isn't when you can consider, all the cheating that's going on. But that's a rise from 8.8% in the tax year of 2019. So there's some possibility. And they also are talking about increasing the audit rates by tenfold on these large complex partners with $10 million or more, which means there's a possibility that people are going to pay what they owe. And this is one of those things where I keep saying, working people pay on every dime of their income. Comes out every week. Comes out of their paycheck like clockwork. But we've got a wealth class that we've created through lower wages, less benefits, less educational opportunities, less healthcare opportunities. You name it, we've sacrificed. Because we were told these are the smart people. They know what to do. They know how to use this money much better than that nasty government. And it's true that they do know how to use it much better than government. They use it on themselves. Do we solve any of society's problems? No. And this is where what's kind of remarkable to me. We hear a lot about philanthropic endeavors. We hear a lot about the philanthropy that's going on. Yet we never seem to really solve these problems. And what we find out is all of this charitable work, a lot of it seems to be just shelters to hide money so that, people can have feel good kind of, issues and jobs. But we don't end homelessness. Jeff Bezos could end childhood hunger. Elon Musk could end homelessness. These people could have real legacies. They could do real things. And what do they choose to do? They play with phallic-shaped rockets. Is that good for humanity? It might be. It might have benefits down the road. But we've got problems now that aren't being addressed. Families are struggling right now because wages are too low. Families have members of their family who are drug addicted or living in poverty or homeless, or name the problem that we're not addressing. So for me, this is a step in the right direction. So my friend who called me out and said, there's nothing transformational. I think there is. I think this administration is making huge steps forward and making ours a more compassionate, more caring, more Christian, if you will, if that's what you need to be a decent person, but a more decent society. I have my Make America Great friends. I go, how about we just make us good? And that starts with helping our neighbors. Want to hear your thoughts, though. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Do you see this as transformational? Do you see this as something that could move us in a more positive direction? And do you see this administration doing the things that we need to get done? I want to hear it. rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Joe Biden's going after Donald Trump in a new ad. The headline was, a convicted criminal who's only out for himself. And it's true. Trump is now a convicted felon, 34 counts. And he's always been out for number one. No doubting that. And, I don't know how effective this ad is going to be, because I know a lot of the Trump supporters, the fact that he is a criminal is what is, and don't take this the wrong way. This is the reason that they support him, because he is a rule breaker. He is someone who doesn't care what others think. Those pesky rules, I'm going to get things done for me. So you remember when he said, I don't pay taxes because I'm smart. People are like, yeah, he doesn't pay taxes. He's smart. This whole idea, I can do whatever I want. I see a woman and I move on her like a grab her by the They voted for him knowing this. So do you think 34 felons is going to matter? No, not really. But they're putting $50 million into an ad buy for June. Where we're going to hear the ad, talking about how Trump's for himself. And the truth of the matter is he is. And now the ad does say, look, we need to make sure that every day, Joe Biden is fighting for average everyday working people, while Trump is, all Trump is talking about is himself. How he's going to get retribution and revenge and all of this stuff. As I keep saying, do I want the guy who talks about getting things done or the guy who gets things done? Biden's been that guy. The other question we hear, and I haven't heard much of it since Alabama Senator Katie Britt, stepped in it. Are you better off, today than you were 4 years ago? Yeah, a lot better off. Democracy wasn't under attack. We're not locked in our homes anymore. Granted, gas was like $2 a gallon, but understand, nobody was buying gas. The oil companies are like, we got all this gas, nothing to do with it. Nobody's on the roads. But never mind that. But 4 years ago, Donald Trump was asked an interesting question He was about to have a big rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And he was asked by a reporter. He said, look, you know, COVID cases are on the rise in 22 states, including Oklahoma, where you plan to hold a big rally. Aren't you worried about people getting sick? So he's asked point blank 4 years ago. Now, are you worried about people getting sick at your big rally? And his response was, no, we're not concerned, actually. No. And the reason I bring this up is because, you know, the 2022 Tulsa rally on June 20th was one that Herman Cain attended. Now, you may remember Herman Cain. He was a Republican presidential candidate, had the 99, I think it was 999 was his plan. And he also, every piece of legislation would be 2 pages long because, of course, you know, big complex problems can be, you know, boiled down to a few talking points on 2 pages. But he attended the June 20th rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma. There are pictures of him not wearing a mask. There are pictures of people in the crowd not wearing a mask. So long story short, June 29th happens. Herman Cain is tested positive for COVID-19. Admitted to an area hospital 2 days later. He passes, you know, at the end of the month, on July 30th, he passed at the age of 74. So he fought it for a while. And I remember during that period, people saying, no, he didn't get it in Tulsa. No, it isn't COVID was the other thing. No, he had cancer years ago. It's the cancer that got him. They were so concerned that people would go, hey, Herman Cain died of COVID. He was one of the anti-vax people. He was one of the anti, you know, mask people. He was one of those. Because I remember, you know, July 2nd is what they're saying. The Cain staff said, there's no way of knowing how he got it. There's no way of knowing where he got it. Who knows? You know, who knows? You know how we know? Mark Meadows, evidently, as quoted in Cassidy Hutchinson's book, Mark Meadows said that, quote, we killed Herman Cain. And look, I'm not pleased about that. I want no one to die from this. But it's interesting that the people who are out there saying it's not a big deal, don't wear the mask, don't do all this stuff, are the ones who are suffering from it. And in a functional society, we would point out, you go, look, you know, people do dumb things. There are consequences for dumb things. So the former pizza tycoon, you know, passed from the thing that he said wasn't a big deal and did it and got it from a guy who said he wasn't concerned. And for me, this is a kind of an important little story in that, as I've always said about Donald Trump, I believe he only cares about himself. I believe he only cares about number one and the rest of us can step in number two, which sadly we have done. Every time he talks about something on a policy front, it's hollow. It's empty. There's nothing there. You know, I remember repeal and replace Obamacare. And he talked a great game. We're going to have the best. It's going to be universal. It's going to be portable. It's going to be cost effective. It's going to be cheap. You're going to get everything you want, and it's going to cost virtually nothing. And you go, well, do you have a plan for that? Well, we've got a secret plan. Let's first destroy what's there, and then we'll roll out. And I, at the time, was saying, look, we know what the plan is. It's what the Heritage Foundation and not the original Heritage Foundation, plot, which was the Affordable Care Act. What came later, you know, after they realized, oh, the Democrats took our idea and did all the things we said to do. But, you know, we can't give them the win. So we've got to come up with some other bad ideas. So we couldn't repeal and replace that. What you ended up with is, well, we have a plan. And had they come out with a plan and said, look, this is what we're going to replace it with, I'm sure they would have gotten some support. They had nothing. Not even the bad ideas, I think. And this is what, when I think of Trump, because we lived through 4 years of a Trump presidency, this is what I think of. What's the saying? All hat and no cattle? This is a guy who's all hat, no cattle. There's no substance there. I like Joe Biden because there's substance to the policies. There's a goal. There's an aim. There's a direction. There's a point. And it's not just anger. It's not just, hey, look at me. It's not, let's turn a funny phrase or call somebody a name. It's actually directed at making lives better. And that's what I like about Joe Biden. And that's what I like about the fact that the policies that they're moving on are about rebalancing our economy in a way where there is some fairness. There is a place where if you work hard and play by the rules, you can actually get ahead. There are opportunities there. That's what I like about it. And I hope as the days, weeks, and months come along, I hope more people come on board and realize one guy's full of a lot of hot air. The other guy's just showing up with his jelly bucket and doing the job. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. When we come back, Scott Paul's going to be here to share some thoughts on a new report that they've got out over at the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Back after this.
The Shaw, WAUK. This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price for the overnight. Mostly clear skies, gusty south winds up around 25 miles per hour. Our sunrise temperatures in the lower 70s. For your Wednesday, showers and storms developing in the afternoon. Mostly sunny skies, south winds, highs in the middle 80s. It's 78 at our studios.
Max Inc. on Civic Media, live in the lair with Kaylin Cole.
Have you ever walked away from a karaoke performance thinking, yeah, that was a lot better than the original person?
Oh my gosh, I don't know if I should admit that or not.
I think you should. Because now I know. Now we know there's a song.
Jimmy's talking on it now.
I know. Oh, you're going to get me in trouble, Jimmy.
It's live in the lair. Grab the podcast now at MaxIncRadio.com and listen live on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So last week, a new report dropped by our good friends over at the Alliance for American Manufacturing. And look, you know, it's stuff that we've been talking about for a long, long time. So no surprise here, but an important must read. It's titled Shockwaves, the Ripple Effect on China's Industrial Overcapacity on American Manufacturing and Factory Workers. This is, you know, a must read. Part history lesson, part cautionary tale, part, hey, stupid, over here. This is what we should be doing. And here to share some thoughts on how we get over there and start addressing these problems, I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it is great to be with you.
So I got to tell you, I'm reading through this stuff and I'm going, yep, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I lived through that. Yeah, saw that. Yep, did that. And then, you know, started going into, you know, where we're going, some of the horrible that's coming. And you've got 10 policy positions on how we get out of this. So I want to talk about the history lesson first, because, you know, you look at the fact that, you know, we've lost, you know, jobs in glass and in steel and in paper and in tires. And you go down the things that we used to produce. Not so much anymore. And it kind of makes you mad. It should make you mad. But what kind of response are you getting?
Yeah. Well, thanks, Rick, for lifting this up, because we do think it's important. And, you know, nothing's going to make your eyes glaze over faster than hearing the word overcapacity, right? It's an economics term. But what it really means is, are we going to have jobs that are good, or are we not going to have jobs that are good? And are we going to fight for free trade, are we going to fight for fair trade, or are we going to get stuck in the same rut that we've been in for so many decades? And for you, for others who lived and experienced the China shock of 20 years ago, I mean, we have short memories in this country, I think, but it was really devastating for these manufacturing communities, and they felt the recession way earlier than the rest of America did during the Great Recession. And, you know, one out of every three manufacturing jobs disappeared between about 1998 and 2010. And entire industries, and you mentioned them, were just really, a lot of firms went bankrupt. We lost market share. We dropped out of first place in manufacturing globally. And at the same time, China was rising. And it wasn't an accident. I guess this thing, you know, we made an unforced error with policy by granting China permanent access to our market at a low tariff rate. At the same time, China didn't live up to its commitments at all. And instead, we saw a bunch of industries wiped out. And so, like, now, for instance, the biggest flat glass company in the United States is a Chinese company that set up shop in Dayton, Ohio, after it wiped out like almost everybody else. So I just don't want to see that for a lot of industries. That's just not healthy for our economic security.
Especially for the things that are going forward. I mean, there are going to be new industries at some point. We'd like to keep them here. But you said it was an unforced error, and I wholly disagree. I think this has worked out exactly as a lot of corporations wanted. They got to exploit cheap labor. They got lax regulations. They got a boatload of money from China. It's worked the way it was supposed to. The only difference is they weren't able to finally at the end control it. And that's where I think we kind of are, because look, I remember you point out one of the things that we need to be doing is reviving this Section 421, was supposedly to help in the transition between having China being a communist market and moving them towards a market economy, as I understand. But I remember the only time that it was invoked was in 2009, as you point out in your piece. It was with the tire industry, and the steel workers actually fought for that to be done. But I remember the companies saying, no, we don't want this. I remember the companies fighting the union because they wanted to move to China.
Yeah, I mean, look, some global tire companies had concerns about it. There's no doubt. I think that there were a number of domestic manufacturers that behind the scenes were either tacitly supporting or giving a wink and a nod because they realized what was happening, right? I mean, they were just getting completely wiped out here.
Or am I remembering this history wrong? Because I remember having people on the show because I remember the tire plant in Findlay, Ohio, or Fremont, same area. The company wanted to move. They were all packing up ready to go.
Oh yeah, look, some of them did. There is no doubt about it. But some of them did. But there were a few who behind the scenes were like, we do need some tariffs in order to keep some of the production that we have here. So, that's part of the rub is that the more globally exposed these businesses are, and by globally exposed I mean like they have factories all over the place and they're importing back to the United States, the less likely they're going to want to get tough on China. So but now we're at the breaking point, so that you have and this is just lifting us forward a few decades, where the big companies that make EVs in the United States, like Ford and GM, have major concerns about Chinese autos, right? And want to see some trade action. And so there has been, and their hands have been burned, right? I mean, I think this is your point, is that, it worked until it didn't work for a lot of these global companies.
No, that's the point. I mean, as you also point out in the report, the solar panels, we should be dominating the world in solar panels. They were invented here in 1954. You go all of this time, we could have been perfecting this, we could have been building this industry, but no, I've got economists and listeners saying, no, we should allow the cheap flood of Chinese solar panels in, because climate change is more important than the jobs, Scott.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they miss an important point. And one is that there would be very little support for clean energy policy if it didn't have a Made in America component. So that's number one. I mean, you wipe out a big part of that coalition, right? And so I think it becomes politically untenable. But I think even more important than that is that this idea that price and cost are the same thing, and they're really not. I mean, the price you pay for a dumped good is very cheap, but the cost, you know, to is enormous. And you're basically helping to preserve a system that exploits labor and the environment, and you're cutting off job opportunities for your neighbors. And there is a big cost to that that comes back to bite you, even if you get a cheap first price there. And in the long run, we're not better off having a system like that. And we're much better off having a system where we make sure that those products are priced the way they should be, and that we're developing those industries in the United States with investing in workers and innovation and having Buy America preferences and developing consumer incentives. And when you do that, you're going to bring the cost down of those vehicles in the United States. And yeah, you're going to keep out the Chinese companies that have direct connections to the government, that have supply chains that are riddled with labor exploitation. And in the case of solar panels, that are making those solar panels in a way that would make any environmentalist blush, because it is not, it's not an environmentally responsible way. So I do think that we need to take on that issue of price, because it's just not, there is a fair market-based price, and then there's the ridiculous. And if it seems too good to be true, it usually is.
Yeah, but we've been sold, our entire lifetime on this hooray for me and the heck with everyone else. So clearly this is going to be something that sells, because I got a good deal and I don't necessarily care about you, until it comes around to where, that was me too.
Yeah. Well, and here's the thing. And this is the way that tariffs work that people don't understand. I mean, if there's a 25% tariff that's put on a product that you want from China, that does not mean that the price that you pay for it is going to go up 25%. But here is what's going to happen. That supplier might renegotiate his supply relationship with the Chinese factory that makes it, or that supplier might look at other markets outside of China to make it, or that supplier might eat some of the margin that he or she was getting in order to keep the market share, because consumers are price sensitive. So even though you saw, for example, tariffs that were put into place on a number of Chinese products, you didn't see the prices, rise in conjunction with that. In fact, the price increases because of the tariffs were negligible, right? Because businesses figure out a way to work it. And so right. This idea that you're going to end up paying a massive amount of money because of a tariff on something, that doesn't come to bear. Now, there is a difference here. We're putting 100% tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles because we don't want them in the market, because it would blow up the market in the United States and wipe out our domestic manufacturers and leave China with all the market share. And that would be bad in the long run for consumers in the United States, because they wouldn't have that choice of vehicles that they want.
Yeah, but as David Ricardo said, in the long run, we're all dead. I want my cheap stuff now. I mean, that should be the follow-up to that. I want my cheap stuff now, because that's what we're being sold. And look, I saw, Donald Trump went and met with congressional Republicans last week, and one of his policy ideas, again, he throws out a lot of stuff. One of the ideas that he threw out was going to eliminate federal income tax and have higher tariffs. And immediately, yeah, Everyone in the econ world lost their mind. And he does this stuff on purpose to get a reaction, to get his name in the paper. He's never going to be able to do this, but it's to get right. That reaction. And it's amazing on both sides of the aisle how fast people went. Janet Yellen, for instance, said, well, that would make life unaffordable. So it's reinforced on all sides. So I'm not surprised when working people go, no, tariff's bad.
Yeah. Yeah, because there is that hyperbole, right? And what Trump says and what Trump does are different things, and it's easy to pick on that. The reality is, though, that we should not be afraid to utilize tariffs as a tool of economic policy in the United States. But to be effective, Rick, I think that almost always it has to be accompanied by investing in people, investing in innovation, investing in your industry in the United States, and not, you know, and I know Trump talked about income taxes. I think he also talked about corporate taxes too, is like cutting corporate taxes massively. And our experience with that has been, just because you cut regulations and taxes for big corporations doesn't mean that they'll move jobs here. In fact, that just hasn't been the experience over the last 20 to 30 years. They pocket the difference and they try to make even more, but they don't bring the work back to the United States. There is just no data that supports that. And so, yeah, tariffs can be part of a policy mix, but we need sensible tax policy as well. And we need those investments that we want to make in the industries of the future and in workers in the United States.
Yeah, no, ultimately, I'm a big believer, and we've talked about this a million times, domestic production for domestic consumption. We need to be making things here. I understand we can't make everything and those things we trade, but for the better of society, having good jobs domestically where you can afford to make a living and then go into the marketplace and consume, I think that's the best way. I do want to get a couple of thoughts on the policy prescription that you came up with here in this Shockwaves report. And again, you know, we're going to bring the excitement because, you know, Section 421, Section 232, 301. I'm already lost in the jumble of numbers.
Yeah.
What are you throwing out here?
Yeah, here's the bottom line, is that we have to, in our trade policy, have an arsenal of tools that can respond rapidly to damage that's going to be done by China's overcapacity. Okay, we can't wait till the damage has been done, because then it's going to be too late. So that's fundamentally what we are urging on the tariff front, is that they need to be more proactive. And again, Biden has just done this with EVs coming from China. We don't get a lot of EVs coming from China right now, but we don't want to. And so that's why those tariffs were put on. But this is also true in some other industries. We also think that we need to tighten up some of the incentives that are being provided in clean energy to make sure that they're not being applied to Chinese products, basically, or that those Chinese products are getting in through other countries and trying to avoid tariffs altogether. So that's the essence of our policy argument here, is that it's not rocket science in terms of how we deal with this, but that we do have to take it head on. And the last thing, and this is something, by the way, that Trump was totally unwilling to do, is I think we do need to work with our allies, because we're stronger with the united front, and you can't play one trading block off the other then. And so, you know, we want to encourage the EU, the European Union, to put its own tariffs in place on EVs, which it seems willing to do. They should be higher, but at least they've started that process, and we need to continue and build on that, because we will be stronger if we're in this together.
Yeah, no, you talk about overcapacity and the idea of just dumping and flooding our market with cheap stuff that there's just no way that American firms can compete with. I'm sorry, you just don't, you know, just in a basic sense of fairness, in a basic sense of how to run a society, that's horribly disruptive and destructive and shouldn't be allowed on either side of the aisle. So do you find, and I guess this is where I want to kind of wrap this up, do you find that this message is unifying? Is this something you think can bring both sides of the red hat, blue hat world into the hard hat world? Because look, I look at this stuff and you go, this is America first. If you're one of those crowds, this kind of stuff should be stuff that you go, yeah, I'm willing to work with anyone to achieve this.
Yeah, I think there is that possibility. And obviously, there's degrees of agreement too, Rick. It may not be 100% agreement, but I think we're getting closer to a general consensus on that. And you've seen the shift in the Democratic Party, and I think it's been pretty welcome, right? I mean, it's not complete, but I think it's been welcome. And among Republicans, you know, there's still that divide between kind of like the Trump folks and then the business roundtable, kind of big business folks as well, who will always oppose a policy like that. So there is a split, but I do think that there's a conversation that could be had. I do wish that the Republican populace that support tariffs would also support these domestic investments in infrastructure, in semiconductors, in these other industries, because I do think that is, you know, an important part of the solution here. And that's the way we've done it in America. I mean, that's the way Lincoln did it, or Henry Clay proposed it, or Hamilton proposed it, or what have you. It's been a combination of that that has been the most effective. And that's what we need to get back to.
Oh, absolutely. Scott, as always, great stuff. Appreciate the time. Look forward to having you back again real soon.
Thank you so much, Rick. Appreciate it.
Our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Make sure you check out their new report, Shockwaves, the Ripple Effect of China's Industrial Overcapacity on American Manufacturing and Factory Workers. We'll just put it out on social media. You can find it there. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day that the St. Paul Federation of Women Teachers, Local 28, received their charter from the American Federation of Teachers. That next February, the Minnesota Women's Union was joined by the St. Paul Federation of Men Teachers, Local 42. Organizing separate locals by gender was common at the time. It was not until 1957 that the teachers united together into one local. One of the founding members of the women's local was Mary McGuff. Mary had been a teacher since 1903. She was still an active participant in the union in 1946 when the Women Teachers Local 28 led the first organized teacher strike in United States history. At the time, the idea of a teacher strike was practically unheard of. In fact, strikes by public sector workers were explicitly forbidden and illegal. Despite this, 90% of the teachers voted to walk out on strike. The core issues of the strike were improving education, including a demand for smaller class sizes, and improving the crumbling infrastructure of the city's public school system. The men's local joined the women on the picket line, but it was the women who organized the action. Mary McGuff was nearly 60 years old at the time. During the six-week strike, Mary took to the radio. Her voice shared the story of the strike with the public. One striker remembered that Mary was able to cut politicians to threads, but did it in a very ladylike fashion. Finally, the strike ended in victory for the teachers. In 1969, the union established the Mary McGuff Award, which honors teachers for the advancement of education in the St. Paul schools. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryintwo.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So again, the report's titled Shockwaves. We'll get links out on how folks can take a look at that, because I think it's important to read this stuff and understand where we've been, where we've come from, what's happening, and maybe the pathway forward. But for me, the bigger discussion is, you know, what kind of an economy do we want to have? For too long, we've been listening to economists, you know, talk about efficiencies of markets and invisible hands and, you know, all of this real economist stuff. It's not called the dismal science for no reason. Because look, it's about squeezing the quarter till the eagle screams. It's about getting rid of redundancy and taking advantage of synergy. And it's all about lowering cost for firms and more profit and more efficiency and more products and all of this stuff. Doesn't really take into account much about the workers, much about the societal goods or the externalities that generally end up on the backs of society. We don't talk about that enough. And it's by choice, because look, the people who fund our business schools, business. These are people who, you know, they have an agenda, which is why when the Koch brothers give money to universities to have veto power over economics professors, that's real power. Because when you start thinking about what we were all taught in Econ 101, tariffs are bad, unions are bad, taxes are bad, all of these things are bad, and it's been hammered into us from the very minute. And it's in every part of our society. You know, I can't tell you right and left how many people have come to me, you're advocating for tariffs? That's terrible. It's bad for prices. It's bad for consumers. It's bad for, you know, the poor. And you go, what about the workers? Well, you know, we're going to crush those industries. And I've actually heard economists say, I don't care where things are made. I don't care if they're made, you know, in Honduras or Nicaragua or China. Don't care. Just as long as I get the cheapest stuff possible, the most competitive price possible. And that's taking into account that, you know, there is a competition going on. The reality is, and this is where I think Scott's report is so important, they have rigged the game. Massive subsidies going to these firms because their model is, we've got to keep our people working. Our society only stabilizes when we're producing so much stuff and flooding the rest of the world. Don't care about your local economy. Don't care about the political economy, let's say. All we care about is that we're going to build our wealth, our power, our influence off of an export model. And this is what they've done. And, you know, we used to call them surpluses. Now it's overcapacity. Mass surpluses coming out of China. And they've got nowhere to put it. What should happen in a functional economy is, well, they should be laying people off because they got too much stuff, nobody to buy it. Or they should be raising wages so that their consumers can buy their stuff. Instead of flooding the globe with cheap garbage that, well, their people can't afford, thus bringing us all down, is bad political policy. Now, from an economist's point of view, this is the most thorough, efficient way. You know, this is rice and beans, the comparative advantage. The country that, you know, can subsidize the most, can use exploitable labor and exploitable, you know, environmental laws, and basically the bottom feeder. There's where all the manufacturing goes. And in the econ world, that's a good thing. It's the most efficient use of resources. Instead of, you know, what I've been saying is we've got to look at what kind of an economy do we want, and what kind of a political environment we want, which is why when I was in school, I studied political economy, the use of resources and how it affects people, how it makes lives better. Not the dismal science of how we squeeze the quarter till the eagle screams, but how we make people's lives better, how we allocate the resources that we have in a way that just doesn't make profit for a handful, but benefits society as a whole. I'm not talking about socialism and government owning the factors of production, so don't send me angry, stupid emails like that. I'm talking about how do we have policy that encourages a competitive environment, but has guardrails that protects consumers and workers and the neighborhoods and the air, the water, all of that stuff. How do we have an economy that works? Instead of one that, well, nothing we can do, it's the invisible hand. And yes, the invisible hand's been giving you the invisible finger for all these years, which is why so many people are upset. It's a different way of thinking. And this is where I think Biden is moving us in the right direction. But even he's getting attacked. Tariffs are bad. And again, it's in all of the language we use and the assumptions that we all make. You know, I was reading an article about Trump's brainchild of, we're going to do away with all the federal taxes and we're going to do tariffs, which is really not a great idea. But Janet Yellen, you know, said it's going to make life unaffordable if we do that. And in the article, they wrote that the cost of the tariffs, however, would undoubtedly be passed on to the consumers, resulting in higher prices and on any type of product that's imported. And one, my mind goes, I'm not horribly opposed to that because I believe in domestic production for domestic consumption. We should have competitive markets here at home. But it's this undoubtedly passed on. No, not undoubtedly. If the price is too high, consumers aren't going to buy it. It's pretty much that simple. Or am I missing something here? That's the part that I find interesting in all of this. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Tell me what you think, what's on your mind, all of that. You can hit me up at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Also, if you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you will find ours, freespeech.org. That's the website for video content. Make sure you check out the incredible work our friends at Free Speech TV do and all of the great shows there. As always, appreciate you being here. Thanks so much. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.